through the filter in our minds. We connect with our mental filters to create a movie of experience. When our minds also reflect our hearts, we bring healing, harmony, and balance into the world of our experience. In consciousness, we can perceive how all experiences, individual and collective, arise from how we filter the data or information we receive. From an open heart of evolved consciousness, we realize all can be corrected, resolved, and healed in love. From a closed heart of fear, nothing can be truly healed. From victim consciousness, we only have access to a tiny part of the consciousness spectrum. It all begins with the intention to be more open-hearted and to evolve one's consciousness. So let's choose to be the open hearts through which all experience in this world flows. Let's be humble and joyful and be doorways for love and grace, peace and harmony. Such liberation or consciousness leaves us open to receive greater consciousness breakthroughs. And what a golden gift of liberation that is for all. If you want to share Encouragementology with a friend who needs to know they're not alone in this journey of self-discovery, you can visit encouragementology.com or anywhere you stream your content to receive this episode and all others. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram for additional encouragement throughout the week. So I challenge you, step outside your comfort zone this week. Engage in a conversation with someone who holds a different viewpoint. Listen actively and seek to understand their perspective. Embrace the opportunity to see the world through their eyes and watch how it enriches your own. I know you can do it. Thank you for listening to Encouragementology with Kendall Boyson, where we find positive ways to handle some of life's challenges. I stumbled through until the path was clear.
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a global audience produced at a different location every week.
I want to say to you, as I move to my conclusion, as we talk about where do we go from here, we must honestly face the fact that the movement must address itself to the question of restructuring the whole of American society. There are 40 million poor people here. And one day we must ask the question, why are there 40 million poor people in America?
Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was a prophetic radical voice, a humble servant leader who demonstrated the power of nonviolence and resistance in the face of American apartheid, global capitalism, militarism, and poverty.
Dr. King represented a radicalism that was very much threatening to not only the system, but to 75% of white people in America, because he was now critiquing capitalism.
I'm Akua Holt from KPFT Houston. Today on Sprouts, we hear from San Francisco's retired Secretary Treasurer of International Longshore Association, ILWU, Local 10, Clarence Thomas, who speaks on the radical side of Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King was a stalwart supporter of unions and workers' rights. One of the unions that Dr. King was closest to was the ILWU on the West Coast, built out of a struggle for a union hiring hall and against business unionism, which dominated the International Longshore Association, ILA. One of the struggles this union led was the integration of the docks in San Francisco. Now more than 60% of the members of ILWU Local 10 in San Francisco are African American. Clarence Thomas, retired Secretary Treasurer of ILWU Local 10, spoke to Pacifica Steve Zelter about Dr. King's relationship with the union and his impact on the struggle of workers today.
But I say that the system doesn't kill dreamers. They kill revolutionaries. And Dr. King had a revolutionary spirit and a revolutionary view. He said, we must see the evils of racism, economic exploitation, and militarism are tied together, and you cannot get rid of one without getting rid of the other. He said that in a speech in August 1967. 1967 was a very pivotal year for Dr. King. And one of the points I'd like to raise is that on September 21st, 1967, some 6.5 months before his assassination, Dr. King spoke at ILWU Local 10. And the occasion was there was major fundraising going on all across the country. And there was going to be a fundraiser at the Oakland Coliseum featuring Joan Baez and Harry Belafonte. But he said he could not come to the Bay Area and not come to Local 10 because he said that Local 10 had strengthened his struggle. I'd just like to refer very quickly. There is a copy I have here of the dispatcher, which is the ILWU Oregon. And so one of the things that Dr. King said when he arrived, he says that I don't feel like a stranger in the midst of the ILWU. We have been strengthened and energized by the support you have given to our struggles. He noted that the civil rights movement is essentially a human rights movement, even though laws may be passed guaranteeing the right to have a job or to rent a home or to use a lunchroom. The Constitution, he noted, does not guarantee the right to have an income or to live in a decent home or to be able to buy food at an unsegregated lunch counter. He talked about the civil rights movement or the Negro freedom movement and the labor movement being one and the same. He said that the same people who oppose labor are the same people who oppose civil rights. And he also made a point of saying that we needed a radical redistribution of wealth, of power, and he believed that ordinary citizens should be able to have major input into their government. He believed in social transformation. And I think that people have been brainwashed about Dr. King in a way to make him a non-radical, to make him an individual who was not connected to the class struggle in any way. And I'd just like to call the audience's attention to this. The 1963 March on Washington, where he gave his famous I Have a Dream speech, the March on Washington was a movement that started in 1941, led by A. Philip Randolph. And so the March on Washington in 1963 was a culmination of struggle by labor. And this particular march was about jobs and freedom. And I think that some people have forgotten that Dr. King was against police brutality. He faced it. And when he and other people were out there demonstrating on the streets, the South, facing dogs and billy clubs and bayonets. He was a man who was attacked by the police. He was jailed by the police. He was brutalized by the police. He was a man who faced danger from racists and mobs. And he was a guy who had courage, you know. And so much of what he was about has been forgotten. And I would say that the focus on his civil rights advocacy, which was very important, has overshadowed his struggle for economic justice. And that was a very, very important part of his struggle.
I want to say to you, as I move to my conclusion, as we talk about where do we go from here, we must honestly face the fact that the movement must address itself to the question of restructuring the whole of American society. There are 40 million poor people here. One day we must ask the question, why are there 40 million poor people in America? And when you begin to ask that question, you're raising a question about the economic system, about a broader distribution of wealth. When you ask that question, you begin to question the capitalistic economy. And I'm simply saying that more and more, we've got to begin to ask questions about the whole society. We are called upon to help the discouraged beggars in life's marketplace. But one day we must come to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. It means that questions must be raised. You see, my friends, when you deal with this, you begin to ask the question, who owns the oil? You begin to ask the question, who owns the iron ore? You begin to ask the question, why is it that people have to pay water bills in a world that's two-thirds water? These are words that must be said. Now, don't think you have me in a bind today. I'm not talking about communism. What I'm talking about is far beyond communism. My inspiration didn't come from Karl Marx. My inspiration didn't come from Engels. My inspiration didn't come from Trotsky. My inspiration didn't come from Lenin. Yes, I read Communist Manifesto and Das Kapital a long time ago. And I saw that maybe Marx didn't follow Hegel enough. He took his dialectics, but he left out his idealism and his spiritualism, and he went over to a German philosopher by the name of Feuerbach and took his materialism and made it into a system that he called dialectical materialism. I have to reject that. What I'm saying to you this morning, communism forgets that life is individual. Capitalism forgets that life is social. The kingdom of brotherhood is found neither in the thesis of communism nor the antithesis of capitalism, but in a higher synthesis. It's found in a higher synthesis that combines the truths of both. Now, when I say questioning the whole society, it means ultimately coming to see that the problem of racism, the problem of economic exploitation, and the problem of war are all tied together. These are the triple evils that are interrelated. So I conclude by saying today, and we have a task, and let us go out with a divine dissatisfaction. Let us be dissatisfied until America will no longer have a high blood pressure of creeds and an anemia of deeds. Let us be dissatisfied until the tragic walls that separate the outer city of wealth and comfort from the inner city of poverty and despair shall be crushed by the battering rams of the forces of justice. Let us be dissatisfied until slums are cast into the junk heaps of history and every family will live in a decent sanitary home. Let us be dissatisfied until the dark yesterdays of segregated schools will be transformed into bright tomorrows of quality integrated education. Let us be dissatisfied until integration is not seen as a problem, but as an opportunity to participate in the beauty of diversity. Let us be dissatisfied until men and women, however black they may be, will be judged on the basis of the content of that character, not on the basis of the color of their skin. Let us be dissatisfied. Let us be dissatisfied until every state capital be housed by a governor who will do justly, who will love mercy, and who will walk humbly with his God. Let us be dissatisfied until from every city hall justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. Let us be dissatisfied until that day when the lion and the lamb shall lie down together. And every man will sit under his own vine and fig tree, and none shall be afraid. Let us be dissatisfied. Until men will recognize that out of one blood, God made all men to dwell upon the face of the earth. Let us be dissatisfied until that day when nobody will shout white power, when nobody will shout black power, but everybody will talk about God's power and human power.
The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his groundbreaking speech, Where Do You Go From Here? Chaos or Community, at the 11th Annual Southern Christian Leadership Conference in 1967 in Atlanta, Georgia. The speech, which later became a book, was Dr. King's analysis of the state of American race relations and the movement after a decade of civil rights struggles in the U.S. You're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio production of global interest. I'm Akul Holt from KPFT Houston and from COVID Race and Democracy. And today we are talking about the radical side of Dr. Martin Luther King with retired Secretary Treasurer of ILWU, Local 10, Clarence Thomas.
I recall so vividly when Dr. King was assassinated, I had a black literature class by Sonia Sanchez with our professor, and I can remember her class being canceled because of Dr. King's assassination. But let me just say this. Dr. King represented a radicalism that was very much threatening to not only the system, but to 75% of white people in America. Folks, you and I remember, Steve, but Dr. King was a very reviled figure right before his assassination. If you remember his criticism of the Vietnam War, when he talked about racism and materialism and critiquing capitalism, even members of the civil rights community broke away from him because he was now putting the system on trial. He was now critiquing capitalism. And this was very, very disturbing to the state as well as to corporate America and to most whites because it made them feel very, very uneasy. And I even think that it had a lot to do with why we see today the right-wing Republicans doing such things as censoring certain books that are in the schools. They're censoring the 1619 Project. Anything that depicts the real history of America in terms of its white supremacy, systemic racism, and Jim Crow, and all of that. I remember Dr. King making a speech many years ago where he said that it was not the Protestant work ethic that had to do with the development of capitalism. It was the enslavement of African Americans that was the foundation of that. And so this is a man who was reviled before he passed away, before he was assassinated, and people have forgotten all about that. He was not admired at all. And so we need to be very clear about Dr. King, who he was, and what he was all about. And let me just say this to you. In 2004, the ILWU Local 10 in San Francisco initiated the Million Worker March. The Million Worker March was about the mobilization of working people and their allies to advance a people's agenda and build a movement independent of the Democratic Party. Why am I bringing this up? It is because we saw this movement as a continuation of the Poor People's Campaign, which Dr. King and the Southern Christian Leadership Organization was leading in 1968. Of course, Dr. King was killed in April, and he never lived to see the development of that movement. But we saw that as the continuation of that struggle. As a matter of fact, Sister Coretta Scott King endorsed the Million Worker March. Martin Luther King III endorsed it. And as a matter of fact, Martin Luther King III even attended the Million Worker March. But in our mission statement of the Million Worker March, we quote Dr. King in saying, 36 years ago, Martin Luther King summoned working people across America to a poor people's march on Washington to inaugurate a war on poverty at home. Quote, the United States is at a crossroads in history. It is critically important for us as a nation and society to choose a new path and move on with resolution and courage. He believed that it was necessary for a coalition of the white and black and people of color working class to come together and put forward a working people's agenda. And I think that that's what's missing right now. That's what's missing. And if we don't do something to continue that work and to put forward a meaningful workers' agenda, independently of the Republican Democratic parties, that we are facing a civil war in this country. I believe that very, very strongly. And so when we talk about Dr. King's legacy, we have to be able to tell the whole story. When Dr. King spoke that night in 1967 at Local 10, he was made an honorary member of Local 10. And I think that it's important for people to know that Dr. King acknowledged what he had learned, what the civil rights movement had learned from the labor movement. For an example, the sit-ins, that particular strategy of sitting in at lunch counters and other venues, Dr. King said that they learned that from the United Auto Workers strike in 1937 in Flint, Michigan, where the workers took over the plant and sat. He talked about those things. Many folks are aware that Dr. King was in Memphis, Tennessee, supporting sanitation work who did not have medical coverage and did not have the fundamentals of what all working people should have. That's where he was assassinated. But that wasn't his only connection with the labor movement. He spoke at AFL-CIO conventions. He attended picket lines. This is a man who was very, very active. You know, people are so accustomed to seeing Dr. King in a suit and tie, but he was also a man who would put on his dungarees and overalls and would be out there in the streets with people. And we know that from the various videotapes of him being on the streets, putting his life on the line with others, challenging this system. So I think it is incumbent upon all of us to tell the real story of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King and his relevance to the struggle today. He understood that this was fundamentally a class struggle. He understood that because he saw that capitalism only served the interests of the ruling class. And so he thought that the necessities of life for all working people were sacrificed in order to provide luxuries for the few. And we cannot overlook that. We need to embrace that. And we need to also understand this. All people who work for a living have something in common. I don't care if you're Black, white, Asian, Pacific Islander, South America, South Asia, it does not matter. Because we as workers hold intrinsic value. You mentioned that I am a retired member of the ILWU, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. We are some of the most important and powerful workers in the world. Well, people might say, well, why would you say that, Clarence? Well, the global economy, the supply chain rests in our hands. Capitalism is based upon global trade. And let me just say this, longshore workers are responsible for the loading and unloading of maritime cargo all over the world. And when we don't work, the supply chain is disrupted. That means that items that come off of a ship, which are automobiles, clothes, computer, cell phones, shoes, foods, wines, oil, agricultural products of various descriptions. And those particular commodities are then placed on trains and trucks and moved. And when longshore workers refuse or don't move that cargo, the global economy shuts down. That's the power that we have. And we also are essential workers. And so understanding that, that provides us with a great deal of leverage. And we have used that leverage over the years. I just like to call attention to how we use it in 1934 when there was a West Coast maritime waterfront strike. And one of the major demands during that West Coast waterfront strike was the right for workers to have a hiring hall where they could democratically and fairly dispatch jobs and not have fake union bosses handing out jobs based on nepotism, ethnocentrism, kickbacks, and the like. And that was very, very important. And workers making that demand, they were called communists, Bolsheviks. As a matter of fact, the shipping companies at that time were called the shock troops of capitalism. And they thought that the demand for a hiring hall controlled by workers, for there to be a 6-hour-a-day workday, for there to be a coast-wide agreement, they thought that was a radical idea. And the way that we were able to win those demands was through a strike. And I would also say that we had approximately 6 or 7 people who died during that West Coast waterfront strike. And in San Francisco, on July 5th, 1934, there were 2 people who died. One was a longshore worker. The other one was a Marine cook, belonged to the Marine Cooks and Stewards Union, both shot and killed by the police. And to this day, every July 5th, ILWU members shut down for 24 hours to commemorate their sacrifice as martyrs. I bring this up because there are so many lessons that can be learned from that struggle that tie in directly to what the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King believed in. He believed that all workers had value, no matter what their color. And in this country, there's been a great deal of time and effort spent to divide workers on the basis of color, sex, sexual orientation, and even to the degree of using the term middle class as a way of making workers feel that they aren't part of the working class. I read something the other day where they had an analysis of what it is to be a middle class today. And they took various locations from across the country, New York, Chicago, and LA. And so one example was they said, if you made $57,000 in one city, if you make between $57,000 and $158,000, you're middle class. Well, let me just say this. I live here in the Bay Area, and I know that they're charging $3,000 a month for a 1-bedroom apartment in Oakland and these new developments. And so even if you made $50,000 a year, you would really be hard-pressed to afford to live in a place where you had to spend $3,000 a month. So this talking about the middle class is really a way of dividing the working class based upon how much money you make or based upon the kind of work that you do.
That was Clarence Thomas, San Francisco's retired Secretary Treasurer of International Longshore Association, ILWU, Local 10, and Pacifica Steve Zeltzer.
That's it for Sprouts. You have been listening to The Radical Side of Dr. Martin Luther King,
excerpts from Dr. King's speeches provided by the Pacifica Radio Archives. Special thanks to our guest, retired Secretary Treasurer of ILWU Local 10, Clarence Thomas, produced and hosted by me, Akua Holt, of COVID Race and Democracy. Production assistance came from Paulina Vasiliev, Steve Zeltzer, and Stephanie Schubert. The Sprout's theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the globe. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase nationally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. I'm Akua Holt in Houston, Texas. Thank you for listening and see you next week on Sprouts.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation